It's amazing how quickly we sometimes forget. The Taliban is telling us to forget about it. Did you see that the other day? The Taliban says we ought to forget all about 9/11, September 11th. We ought to just move on. They didn't do it. You know, we've been urged by our leaders, and we see it continually. They have big ads. I saw one just this morning that involved the banking industry, the tourism industry, the airlines, and all kinds of people were just gushing and happy, and they want you in the malls. They want you buying like yesterday. Matter of fact, they did want you buying yesterday because of the big shopping day of the year, biggest one. And they're encouraging us all to get back to business as usual. I would hate to see the church do that. I would hate to see God's people get back to, quote, business as usual. Because we had quite a wake-up call on the 11th of September. I think it shocked and jarred every one of us to the depth of our being. I think because we understand the truth about who we are and biblical prophecy and what is to happen to the United States and some of the things that we've been told for the last 20, 30, 40 years, those of us who have been around that long, that we didn't expect it to come from that quarter. We didn't really expect perhaps a group of ragheaded terrorists from several Middle Eastern and North African nations to mount such a terrible attack to actually virtually devastate the national economy, almost put some of our major industries out of business and murder some 4,000 to 5,000, are not sure yet of the total number, of our citizens, plus those from about 80 other countries around the world. But it was a wake-up call. It certainly was to me. When I saw those huge buildings come down, I will never forget where I was, what I was doing. I told you before that I was in the air. They made us land, a forced landing at Little Rock, Arkansas. I went in and saw those buildings coming down. I just said, Bin Laden. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I thought, and I wrote as much in the immediate hours following it, that I was watching 25,000 Americans crushed to death, is what I thought that I was seeing. I found out later that those brave firemen got about that number of people out of there, that this took a lot longer than I thought it did, that there were probably an hour and a half or 45 minutes involving one building, that people could actually get down the stairwells and out of there, so there were far more lives saved than would have been had that building or both of them collapsed instantly. Had they collapsed instantly, which is what they had hoped would occur, probably 25,000 people would have died. I think I told people that I thought we'd lost more people in that attack than we did in the entire war in Korea, in which I was involved. Well, that has proved not to be so, and I'm thankful for that. But sometimes we forget the big picture. And no matter how horrendous that attack was, do you notice in your own life or your own mind, do you notice in your own environment, do you notice in the TV shows that are on or the radio or whatever you see in the form of entertainment, that it is getting back to business as usual? That even that kind of a numbing experience is just too horrendous to deal with on a daily basis. You like to put it behind you. You like to try to forget about it. You like to go on, as we say, with our lives. The big picture is what people tend to forget in the field of religion. They forget what life is all about, what we are all about, who we are, why we are here, where we are going, what happens when we die, what is the ultimate goal in our life. Oh, I know we have all the short-term goals. I do, you do, whether it's a new car at 0%, whether it's building a building as we are now, whether it's building a new home, whether it's taking a trip, whether it's a vacation, whether it's a new job, whether it's school, whether it's enlistment in the military. As a young man I talked to a couple of days ago said he was going to the Marines. There are all the short-term goals, but what about the long-term goal of your life and the ultimate end of it? I think you all know that Jesus Christ came preaching a very focused, very central message, and that message was called the Good News of the coming kingdom of God. The word gospel means good news. And a kingdom is a government. It's the government of God that he said was coming to this earth. Let me tell you the things that Jesus did not come to do. He did not come to save the world then. Millions of people think he did. They think that he went across every hill and through every desert, and he followed every stream bed. He walked down every path. He would divert from his course and go anywhere to reach as many people as he possibly could and say to them, like the televangelists do today, oh, won't you be saved? Millions of people are completely deceived about that, and they think that Jesus came to save the world. He did not. He isn't trying to save it today. He did not come to bring a new religion. He didn't come to reform the synagogue, didn't come to start a new religion. Wasn't a new religion at all, was it? He actually emulated, referred to, talked about, and fulfilled the prophecies of the Old Testament. I'll tell you a little later on what he did come to do, but going along with what people think, he did not come to nail the Ten Commandments to his cross. He did not die on a cross. He died on a stauros, or an upright pale, which the Bible plainly translates as tree a couple of times in the book of Acts, in which the original Greek word means, it does not mean something with a cross member, although it had a patibulum or a board across the top of it with the characters that said, "This is Jesus Christ, the King of the Jews." But his arms were not nailed to that. He did not come to give men idols, icons, weird headgear, beards, or strange uniforms and weird kinds of dresses. He didn't come to tell his disciples they should celebrate Christmas, Easter, and Halloween. He did not come to start up orders for women and tell them that they ought to be celibate, shave their heads, and dress up in weird costumes that look like a high wind would cause them to fly. He did not come to install chants, candles, beads, altars, or statues in gloomy, big, stony cathedrals. He didn't come to do away with the Old Testament. He didn't come to tell us that it's all right to eat crabs, pigs, lobsters, snails, rattlesnakes, armadillos, and assorted roadkill. He did not come to give us license to divorce, commit abortion, ordain homosexuals into the ministry, and advocate gay rights. He didn't come to do away with the death penalty for murder. He didn't come to start over 400 different bickering denominations and hundreds of cults along the line with a large number of mainstream churches. He didn't come to do any of those things at all. But people under the guise, under the banner, under the name of Jesus Christ, do all those things. And business as usual in the United States, that I've been harping on a little bit and writing about on my Word From at the website, means going back to what Hillary Clinton said about gay rights. It means going back to what some of the large state-old churches like the Episcopal Church are doing with regard to ordaining lesbians or homosexuals in their clergy. It has to do with all that we call American acceptable society. And I concluded a week ago by asking whether or not we think that we're going to go to Afghanistan and give them all that we have, including heavy metal, drug abuse and addiction, pornography, all of the things that the United States has, the incredible amount of our absorption, because we're the biggest customers of, they're the biggest growers of heroin, and we're the biggest customers of the heroin that they grow. So I guess if we turned that around, they'd have to what? Mainline their own heroin, I guess. So do we want to give them, as I said, miniskirts and gay rights, and then all the wonderful Afghanis will have the liberties and the freedoms that we enjoy? Now, why did Jesus Christ come? Here are just some of the reasons he came, probably the most of them, probably the lion's share of them. He came to disqualify the present evil world ruler, who is an exalted spirit called Satan the devil, who is identified clearly, 2 Corinthians 4:4 and Ephesians 2:2, as the god of this world, Revelation 12:9, who deceives all nations, who is the prince of the power of the air. He came to disqualify the present evil world ruler. Two, he came to qualify as the future world ruler. Three, he came to call out from the world to train and to commission his disciples. Four, he came to build his church. Five, he came to die for the sins of all men and women. Six, he came to fulfill dozens of prophecies about his messiahship. Seven, he came to set us an example that we should follow in his steps and live life the way he lived it. Eight, he came to confirm the new covenant with many, and it was ratified in blood. The next one, he came to show the way to salvation. Next one, he came to lift the law to a spiritual level or a spiritual plane. He came to qualify to become our daily high priest. He came to leave prophecies like the Olivet prophecy concerning major world events leading up to the time of his return. He came to die, to be resurrected, and to ascend the right hand of God the Father on high. There are all kinds of things that Jesus Christ did and said and thought that he caused to be written, that he left us in his example, that are not believed, not accepted by the mainstream churches of this world at all. Most people would disagree with almost everything I've said here, except just one or two little things when I talk about dying for the sins of the world. They can go along with that, but they don't know what death is, and they're not even sure he was dead. They think he was down in hell, witnessing, taunting to departed spirits. Check the mainstream theology. A lot of the people who go to the big churches don't even know their own ministers learned that in the seminary. But they did, and that is their doctrine. So really, they say he wasn't really dead. He was in hell, witnessing to departed spirits, is what they teach. And that isn't true. When you really focus on what Jesus Christ did and said, you get the big picture. And if you do that, and you concentrate on it, you won't drift back into the business-as-usual attitude that a lot of people do. I would really hate to see us drift back into the business-as-usual attitude in the church, which includes people gossiping and harping about each other, little picky things, you know, picking slivers out of our own flesh and impeding the progress of the work, being unforgiving, intolerant, judgmental, hypercritical. I would really hate to see that happen. I'm going to take you through some prophecies back in the book of Daniel that will take us all the way back to 497 B.C., and I want to tell you a little bit about the background, because this is 2,499 years ago when the book of Daniel first began to be ripped apart, placed under careful scrutiny, and analyzed, dissected by the higher critics, German rationalists. They decided, first of all, that Daniel couldn't have written it. Then they decided that the man who wrote it, whoever he was, lived after the events that he wrote about. Well, that's really hard to deal with, isn't it? Because he lived after the seventh resurrection of the Roman Empire. He lived after the creation of the empires, which did not come for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years after the book was published. After it was begun to become extant, it was mentioned by Jerome and Arnobius and Eusebius and the Anti-Nicene Fathers, and has the credence of a Bible book accepted in the Old Testament canon. Let's begin in the second chapter. This is fascinating material. It shows how Daniel's life was spared. It shows how he became a person who was able, actually, very close to the very top seat of government in the greatest kingdom of that time, and up until that time, the kingdom of Babylon. So in chapter 2, in verse 1, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, and that would have been about 495 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. Not just one dream, it apparently had a repetitious dream. Then the king commanded to call the magicians. They were the magi. And the astrologers, you know what they are. They are observers of times. We have them around us today. And the sorcerers, the word there means wizards or wise men, and the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans were a priestly caste, and they were actually a conflicting political organization. And we will see that there was something afoot here that doesn't immediately meet the eyes. Now, I've said for several decades now, dictators do not groom successors, do they? Dictators, like in Africa, when they would have like a stretch 747 and they would have the Organization of African States meeting somewhere up in Libya or in Cairo, they would take their entire government with them, because the leader of that totalitarian state, whether it was Rwanda, Burundi, or somewhere else, could not trust any of the people in positions of authority and leave them behind. So they took the whole bunch of them to where they could have the armed guards keep their eyes on them. Now, having made that point, notice what happened here. The king called them to show the king his dream, so they came and they stood before the king. We don't know how many there were, 30, 40, 50, or 100. The king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. I like to pause and talk about the teacher who was reading this to a little child. The little child said, then what happened, teacher? Well, right away, then he lived forever. Anyway, it's the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. Now, like soothsayers today, the astrologers had stock answers. They didn't care what kind of a dream. They thought it's a weird guy, and he's probably a drunk, and he's probably dreaming all kinds of junk, and it's going to be kind of interesting, but he's got us on the carpet here, so we better come up with something. And they probably had stock answers which would be so general that he would be mystified and satisfied, and they would be considered to be mystics and psychics, and he would be happy with their answer. But the king really threw them a left curve. He answered, he said, "The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream and the interpretation thereof, you will be cut in pieces and your houses be made into a dunghill." Now think about that for a minute. That's a pretty heavy penalty for not being able to come up with some kind of an answer to a dream, isn't it? Seems like really overkill, doesn't it? Because there was something more going on here than meets the eye. Obviously, there was a conspiracy against him. He'd gotten wind of it. And he was going to use this dream as a method to get rid of all of his adversaries. He didn't think they had a chance, as you say, the snowball in the proverbial place, of answering anything. And so he was determined to get rid of them. He didn't really want them to tell him. He wasn't interested in them coming up with the answer. He'd have been shocked if one of them said, "I know what you dreamed." And he would have been very disappointed as well. "But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof," verse 6, "you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof." They answered again and said, "Let the king tell his servants a dream, and we will show the interpretation of it." The king answered and said, "I know of certainty that you would," notice this, "gain the time." You're trying to put this off. You're trying to gain time because there was something afoot. They needed more time. They needed more time to address their constituency. They needed more time for whatever foreign allies they had been talking to come in and to perhaps deploy. They needed more time for the general people who they had been talking about an uprising to rally behind their cause. So he said, "You would gain the time," delaying tactics because maybe of an impending uprising, "because you see the thing is gone from me. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof." The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, "There isn't a man on earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there's no king, lord, or ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean." Of course, by now they were breaking out in a cold sweat and working to try to preserve their lives. "And it's a rare thing that the king requires, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." Of course, they were a polytheistic society. "For this cause, the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon." He had asked them to do the absolute impossible. He knew it was impossible. Therefore, it was an artifice. And he was getting rid of his political adversaries and people that he feared were trying to overthrow him and kick him off the throne. The decree went forth. Of course, they've always got a palace guard. They've always surrounded with like the Republican guard around Saddam Hussein or like the Secret Service people around our president. They've got people absolutely loyal to them who are heavily armed, and he can send out the word, and you bet they'd go out and arrest them right away. The decree went forth, verse 13, that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said, "Why is the decree so hasty from the king?" So Arioch then explained it to Daniel. Verse 16, Daniel went in and desired the king that he would give him time, and he would show the king the interpretation. Daniel then went to his house. The king must have said, "All right, you've got 12 hours, 24 hours, whatever," he said, "and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah." You learned as a child growing up that there were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but those are their Babylonian names. These are their real names. "That they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision." By the way, the next couple of chapters, chapter 3 and 4, are written not in Hebrew, but in Chaldee. And you could actually call one of these books in the book of Daniel the Epistle of Nebuchadnezzar. if we have time to get to that, because Nebuchadnezzar himself wrote all these words, and they were taken down in Babylonian cuneiform and in Chaldee, and that Chaldean language was actually used by the 70, the Septuagint, who translated the Old Testament into the Greek language down in Alexandria. I just say that in passing, but you can find that out if you look it up in the commentaries. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. That's absolutely true. He has done it, he is doing it, and he will do it. He has that power. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them at no understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might, and has made known unto me now what we desired of thee, for thou hast made known unto us the king's matter. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, captain of the guard, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He said, Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation. And so Daniel became an intercessor, and in one sense is a type of Christ, because he is like a savior to all of those people. He has been given a gift from Almighty God, and there's more here too that meets the eye. I want to pause to say something right here that is quite interesting for you to think about, and I think about this in terms of the past, say, 24, 25 years of church history. You know what was in the palaces in Babylon at that time? All of the wonderful, gorgeous, beautiful gold that Solomon and David had accumulated. There were shields that were made of solid gold. There were all kinds of spears of all kinds of exotic metal. And there were bowls and vessels and pots of every description of solid 24-karat gold. There were beautiful pieces that had actually been decorated and had all kinds of, not idols or figures in that sense upon them, but things like pomegranates, you read in the Bible, and fruit and so on them. And all of them were stored in the treasure house in Babylon. And just as sure as they had been ripped up and taken out of the temple in Judah, and they were stolen treasure, and they were now in Babylon, so they were there begging for vengeance, begging for restitution and restoration, begging for God to take them back where they belong, because these people had stolen from God. They thought they had stolen from these corrupt Jews. They took over the land of Judea, and they stole God's treasures. But eventually, they were brought absolutely down, and the very people who brought them down issued a decree, because Cyrus the Great was called Artaxerxes by the Greeks, and they allowed Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah to go back and rebuild the temple and to get those treasures and to take them back there. And so God took care of it in due time. Interesting to think about people who would steal God's properties, steal God's possessions, steal that which God's people have sweat blood and tears for, and have worked for it and compiled it and put it together and constructed it and had it there, and that people will reach out and take what is not theirs and steal it for their own purposes, and there it sits, waiting for retribution, waiting for repatriation, waiting for justification and vindication. Just something to think about in passing that I was certainly thinking about as I was studying through a lot of this morning. Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, and he said, Bring me before the king, and I'll show the king the interpretation. Verse 25, they were really in haste, and he said, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, his name was Belteshazzar in the language of the Chaldeans, Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof? And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, The secret which the king has demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, magicians, soothsayers, show unto the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Daniel didn't say in the next 10 days, the next 6 months, the next 5 years. He said at the end time, the latter days. The hollow argument that Daniel allegedly wrote these things after they had occurred is so stupid as to not even bear any kind of discussion. Because he wrote about the four great empires, the fourth which was to have seven resurrections, all the way down to the second coming of Christ, to span literally thousands of years. How can anyone write after that event? He didn't write after Otto the Great, did he? Or after Bismarck, or after Adolf Hitler, or after the Battle of Armageddon. No. Daniel wrote back there 2,400 and some years ago. There is a God in heaven that reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed are these. As for thee, O king, your thoughts came into your mind upon your bed, what should come to pass hereafter. And he that reveals secrets makes known to you what shall come to pass. Daniel did not take any credit for himself. He gave every bit of credit to God. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living. But for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, that you might know the thoughts of your heart. Thou, O king, saw, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and arms of silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. You saw till that a stone was cut out without hand. It seemed to just dislodge itself supernaturally, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. If you remember the horrifying sight of the Twin Trade Towers slowly collapsing. Here was a stone, a shimmering white stone, that was cut out without hand, dislodged seemingly from a giant slab of a mountain. It came hurtling down like a meteorite, and in the vision, it smashed this image on its feet. The image was four stories and some odd feet high. It was over a four-story building in height. We will see later on where he actually must have thought about the dimensions that he saw in what he did. It began to collapse, starting with the base of the image, and all of it, as it slowly collapsed, turned to so much dust and rubble. And so, he said, it broke them to pieces. They were broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away. A great wind carried them away, just like a dust cloud. And suddenly the place where the great image stood was just gone, nothing left. That no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain. So the stone is still there, and in the vision, Nebuchadnezzar saw it seemingly to grow and grow and grow, and it's as if he saw the world, and this gigantic rock became so huge that it absorbed the entire world, the farthest horizon, and it filled the whole earth. Did it look like a pyramid shape? It might have, I don't know, but it was a huge rock. You can read Deuteronomy 32, where you see that Jesus Christ, the one who became Christ, is called our rock, and he is the rock of our salvation, and mentioned many, many times in the Psalms of David. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. That was a shocking revelation to Nebuchadnezzar, no doubt, because he thought he had done it all by himself. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, has he given into your hand and made you a ruler over them all, you are this head of gold. And after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, it shall break in pieces and bruise. Notice that each one is inferior in value, yet stronger in its tensile strength, in the kind of metal. Gold being the softest and the most malleable, and then silver, very malleable and soft, but nowhere near as soft as gold, and then brass, which can be very, very hard, and iron, which can actually break brass. And whereas you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, and there shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. If you mixed iron poured out of a mold into a form, and poured out of a bat into a mold to form some kind of a metal tool or implement of some kind, it wouldn't be any good, would it? Because it would be just shot through with all kinds of holes and be very, very weak. It might hold together a little while, but it wouldn't hold together long. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly weak, as it should read in the original. Partly broken is incorrect, partly weak. And whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. What are we talking about here? Not just the image, we're talking about empires, talking about kingdoms, talking about successive world-dominant empires. And sure enough, all the history books, all of the Bible handbooks that read and tell us about Daniel 2 and Daniel 4 and Daniel 7 and Daniel 11 will tell you that they were ancient Babylon, Persia, Greece, Greco-Macedonia, and Rome. And that Rome has had many, many revivals, successive revivals, all the way down through the Middle Ages. And it was in all cases, in all places, and at all times during that protracted period of time when it was called the Holy Roman Empire, a Germanic kingdom in the heartland of Europe. It has had its last resurrection until the time right now in which you and I live this moment. Now, I've written an article that I published on a website. Why is Bonn, Germany, the site of the international meeting under the aegis of the UN and the various coalition partners, chosen for all these people from Afghanistan to come as representatives to try to put together some kind of a transitional government? I have said for decades, after interviewing Franz Josef Strauss and after writing about it for literally 40 years, that a United States of Europe is going to arise in Europe. It is forming. That Germany would reunite. It has. That Germany would become the most powerful nation in Europe. It is. And the euro is going into full circulation in January of this coming year, 2002. It was in the main banks have been using it for almost 2 years now, but the general public from Denmark all the way down to Italy will all be using one coinage beginning in January. Now, back in the 1950s, when I said that, people would say, and one young lady who was actually a nurse in the American military in Germany and saw the shattered shards that were once Dusseldorf and Köln and Bonn and so on, all the rest of them, and Berlin especially, it was about 99% destroyed, she said in retort to the sermon, "That's nuts. It will never, never, never rise again." People didn't think that Germany could ever recover from that horrible devastation in 1945. But in a very few years, they began to recover. In the 1950s, it became known as the Wirtschaftswunder, or the miracle of rebuilding. The people at Wolfsburg were actually breaking up their own furniture and putting in the big ovens to fuel the Bessemer ovens to produce the forms and steel for the little Volkswagens, and they began exporting them to the United States. And in the late 50s and early 60s, Germany began to boom, and it became very quickly, because of the pension of the German worker, and because of the militarism and a martial kind of a mentality that they have, it became a tremendous, powerful nation, and it is today the most powerful nation in Europe, and that includes all of the states of Europe. Now, which nation is it that among its top military decorations is not brass, not gold, not any other alloy except iron? Germany. The Iron Cross is a very coveted decoration. Who was the Iron Chancellor? Bismarck. Now, these are just little asides. I have a major section in the book, Europe and America in Prophecy, that talks about Germany in prophecy and who are the Germans, and you can look that up and read it if you haven't already. But the iron that is mixed with miry clay is a mixture of 10 nations. How many toes are there? 10. How are they divided? East and west. I've always felt that meant five nations, basically to the west of the Oder River, and five nations to the east of the Oder River. Now, some of you may remember this. Cecil will, I think. Maybe the Vances might, and different people. In the 1960s, in the very deepest part of the Cold War, I was saying before tens of thousands of people in live audiences at the Feast of Tabernacles and on television and over radio, you will live to see the time. Remember, this was during the days of Khrushchev and Yuri Andropov. It was during the days when we thought we'd go into nuclear war against the Russians. I said, and I quote, "You will live to see the time when the United States and Russia are once more allied against a common enemy." Now, what took place down in Crawford, Texas the other day? How could I have known that? Well, because I understand Bible prophecy. Because I know who these people are. Because I know that the time for Rosh to intervene is not until after the beast power occupies Palestine and tidings out of the north and east trouble him, and he goes away with great fury to utterly destroy and take away many. Because I know the time sequence of events according to Christ's own Olivet prophecy. And I can document that, by the way. There must be dozens of tapes, and there must be all kinds of things that I've written over the past years that will absolutely prove that I said that. Now, back to this. These 10 toes represent 10 nations, and they are struck by a rock, which is actually Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Now, let's go on. It says in verse 44, "In the days of these kings," the kings represented by the 10 toes, represented in a sense by the whole image, which is Babylon the Great and its successive empires, but by the 10 toes, which is where the stone smashes into the image. The stone does not smash into the golden head or the silver breast or the belly and thighs of brass, but it smashes the image on the toes, on the base of it, where it stands. And it becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. "In the days that these kings," verse 44, "shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." When Nebuchadnezzar heard that, it gave him an idea. He thought, yeah, I am a head of gold, aren't I? And his mind got filled with all kinds of vanity. You know, he took over the throne when he was only 17. Now, he may have been in his 40s by now, but he was a young man when he actually acceded to the throne following his father. Well, you see the rest of this about how he fell on his face and worshiped Daniel, and actually gave him, like you might say, a vice presidency, exactly like an executive or administrative job, because when Nebuchadnezzar went crazy, as you read later on, for 7 years, Daniel ran the entire government. And Nebuchadnezzar was out back rooting around, eating grass, and without any clothing on, acting like a madman, which of course he was. So Nebuchadnezzar got an idea, and he thought, this is me, and so I'll do something about this. Now, chapter 3, verse 1. "Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 3 score cubits, and that's 41 feet, 410 feet, I beg your pardon, 410 feet, 40 stories, the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king set to gather the princes and the governors, the captains, the judges, treasurers, counselors, sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication once the image was finished. And the princes," and it repeats all of that, I won't repeat it all, "and they stood before the image. Then a herald cried aloud," so they had a huge assembly of people there, and here's this towering, gigantic image. "It is commanded you, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music," sackbut was probably like a, oh, maybe bagpipes, it was a leathern thing, it had a couple of pipes protruding through it if you look it up, "you should fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." And it was an image of him. It was his replica. It was his image. And he got the idea, without a shadow of a doubt, from the dream. And so he set it up. They were a polytheistic nation. It was an idol. And he, like so many great dictators, like the Caesars that have passed, wanted to be like a god king. He wanted to be worshipped, but instead of being worshipped directly, he set up an image that he got the idea from the dream that he'd seen. "And whoever does not fall down and worship that same hour will be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace." And this wasn't unique, and it wasn't the first time, because that was a common way that they would put people to death in those days. And some of the paganism had to do with sacrificing children into a fire. "Therefore, at that time," verse 7, "when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people and languages and nations fell down and worshipped the golden image that the king had set up." Now, here is Daniel and the three children, the three princes, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, being used of God to prevent the Jews from going straight into idolatry during their protracted period of Babylonian captivity. If they had not interceded, if this great miracle had not occurred we're about to read about, then the Jews also were included in this edict, and they would have had to have done that any number of times per day whenever the musicians played, maybe three, maybe five, like the midnight haranguer in the minaret of the mosque, and the Muslims would have to pray five times every single day, and the Jews would have done it under pain of being put in the oven, being burnt alive. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Now, they wanted to get rid of the Jews because the Jews were an intelligentsia. They were also very jealous of Daniel, very jealous of the three, they're called holy children, of the princes that were with Daniel. And they spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. So there we are again. Well, that was merely a sign of obeisance and respect and so on. Thou, O king, has made a decree, and they repeat all of that, and whoever falls down will be thrown in the midst of the furnace. Verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. So they managed to really push his button, and Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage. And it says, in his rage and fury, he commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king. And he asked him, is it true that you won't worship the golden image I've set up? And verse 15, he repeats it again. If you worship not, that same hour you're going to be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? You see, when he gave God credit, and later on when he gave God credit, he said to Daniel, your God is a God of gods. He did acquiesce to the idea that Daniel's God was a very powerful God and a God that could produce great miracles. But to him, who was still a polytheist, he did not say, therefore, all of my other gods are to no avail at all. It's just that he is a bigger God, a better God, a super God that is a higher God and a more powerful God than all of my other gods. But he didn't give up on his idolatry. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. That means we're not going to be careful and formulate a very, very careful answer. Because it's a done deal. They were saying, we will take no care. It's useless for us to formulate an answer. We won't do it. Our minds are already made up. And so they said, if it be so, notice the language here. They didn't boast. They didn't say, we know we will be delivered. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us in the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, now this is an example of faith that you ought to stop and think about. This was the same example of faith that Polycarp, that John, that Paul, that Peter, that Stephen, and so many other people faced who were martyrs of God that you read about in that list in the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, who were given an ultimatum. You will either do this, you will curse your God, you will give up on your religion, you will do what I tell you to do, or else I will torture you, I will put you to the sword, I'll throw you to the lions, I'll kill you. Do what you're going to do, but my mind is made up. And there was no vacillation. There was no hesitation. They're not going to say, well, what else comes with it? Or are there any other avenues of reason here? Is there something we can talk about here? Can we strike a deal? No way. Their minds were made up. They had already absolutely dedicated themselves to the truth of God. They were going to stay the course, and they were not going to vacillate. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's just an old awkward expression. Therefore he spake and commanded they should heat the furnace seven times more. And that expression, if you look at the commentary, really means as hot as they could possibly get it. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind them. And they did bind them, and it even goes into great detail in some of the Bible dictionaries about the garb that they wore, which looks about like a modern Afghan, because they wore pantaloons, very large, loose, billowy kind of pants that were gathered at the ankles. And they wore a girdle, and they wore an overgarment, almost like a robe, but it was of a light material, oftentimes a very expensive material, sometimes even silk, and sometimes camel's hair. If you buy a camel's hair coat, you'll find out that it's very expensive. And they actually took their turbans or their girdle, and they just bound them with and in their own garments. They didn't get a rope, but they used their own garments and they bound them in them. And heave ho, but they got so close that the fellows who threw them in there, and I don't know that they got close enough to even throw them, they probably just pushed them a little bit, and you open the door, a big iron door, no doubt, something like that, all of a sudden the oxygen is roaring in there and the flames come roaring out. So the three fall down with their hose, as it's called, or these garments on, and the men who threw them in die. Their hair and their garments catch fire, and they're writhing on the ground, and they die. They are killed. So it says that they fell down bound, verse 22, and Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished and rose up in haste and spake and said to his counselors, "Didn't we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They said, "True, O king." He said, "I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Actually, the original says, "a son of the gods," but the translators couldn't abide with that, so they did it this way, as if Nebuchadnezzar is confessing that it is the Son of God, which he wasn't. He had no knowledge of that at all. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither." So they came forth out of the midst of the fire. And the princes, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire passed on them. They didn't even smell like they'd been near a fire. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." What did that fire depict? Gehenna fire. What did the three holy children or the three princes depict? God's people. What did the one who we know of as Jesus Christ, or at the very least one of the archangels, Michael or Gabriel, depict? A Savior who was right there, able to protect them and take them out of and save them from complete destruction in Gehenna fire. So there's some types that we need to understand here. That the one that saves us from that same fate, who stands right beside us, right up to the very gates of the door, with the flames starting to try to singe our hair, is Jesus Christ of Nazareth. This would be a horrible fate, wouldn't it? There's nothing worse than immolation by flames, nothing that I can imagine that would bring any more pain than burning to death. So there's an example here as well. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his messenger," the original Hebrew is angel, same word, "and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word." And that's what really got his attention. Changed the king's word. He was astonished. "My word was changed," you know, because the vanity of the ego was so great. "And yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I," very quickly he's back on top, very quickly he's to salvage his ruined reputation now, very quickly he's back in charge. "Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." So he promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Now you can see later on, I won't go all the way through it, in the fourth chapter about the dream and about how seven times would pass over him. But let's go to the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel right quickly and notice that four times in this chapter, five times actually, the prophecy begins clear back at the time of Daniel and only ends at the time of the second coming of Christ. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, and Daniel was there for the lifetime, or the rule, actually, of five kings. Nabonidus is not even found in the records, apparently, but I should say that Belshazzar is not found in the records, but Nabonidus is. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel spake and said, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea, and four great creatures, or beasts, came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The sea is used time and again, even in the book of Revelation, as a symbol of masses of people, tens of millions of people. The first was like a lion. That was Babylon. He is actually depicted in the prophecies of Jeremiah and Isaiah as a lion that would come out of the north. And it had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, much is said here that I want to tell you about real quickly. First of all, in Birs Nimrud, in the excavations, and also in the wall that is called the Semiramis Gate of ancient Babylon that I've seen in the Berlin Museum, there are huge, big creatures looking like oxen. They have the head of an Assyrian or a Babylonian king with a neatly coiffed beard and the headdress and a huge oxen's body, and they will have eagle's wings and lion's claws and a lion's tail. So you will have all the four parts of the cherubim, or the host of heaven, that they were commanded not to worship: an eagle, a lion, a man, and an ox. And that was exactly the creatures that guarded the heavenly treasures for all the period of time, one-sixth of the time, up to this time of world history, virtually, prior to the flood of Noah's time, for 1,000 years. Wayfarers who would essay to go back to the site of the Garden of Eden would have creatures like that who would come storming out at them, roaring, fire coming out of their mouths, perhaps, and just frighten them to death. And from that time, in that pre-flood period, and following the time of the children that were aboard the ark with Noah, the stories about dragons guarding treasures, the stories about Jack and the Beanstalk, the stories about great monsters, St. George and the dragon, and so on, in mythology have been handed down from people to people to people down through thousands of years, and I think that's where it all began, and I think that's logical. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, is reference not only to the band that was around the trunk of the great tree, if you look into the fourth chapter, and that depicted Nebuchadnezzar, who is symbolic of the times of the Gentiles, the seven times that were Passover, 2,520 years, during which the nations of this earth are to be ruled by men with the minds of wild animals. Nebuchadnezzar's 7 years of insanity, rooting around in the temple or the palace yard, and being watched over by Daniel, so he didn't hurt himself too badly, is symbolized here. It says, he was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Nebuchadnezzar then made the proclamation. When his sanity returned to him, he understood and finally was, quote, converted, end quote, not spiritually, but at least to believing truly in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Verse 5, and another beast, a second, like to a bear. That was the Persian Empire. All the commentaries agree. All the history books agree. Rawlinson's five great empires agree. All of the histories of that time agree, and history does prove that the great Persian Empire came along with Darius the Mede, and they were actually together, and Cyrus the Great. And it was like unto a bear. It raised itself up on one side and had three ribs in the mouth of it. That was nations that it devoured. And it said, arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, and that depicts Alexander the Great and the Greco-Macedonian Empire, which did succeed that other empire in history, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. Those are the four generals, if I can remember, it was like Seleucus Nicator, Laomedon, Antiochus Epiphanes, and Ptolemy Soter in Egypt were the four generals that divided up the kingdom even before the body of Alexander the Great was interred. And here it is in his prophecy in the Bible. The beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped with the residue of the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. This is the Roman Empire that superseded all of those empires that fell apart following Alexander. There was a period of time of the Ptolemaic and the Seleucidae wars that is covered by Rawlinson as well, and is covered in the 11th chapter of Daniel, at least in type. I considered the horns, and behold, there came upon among them another little horn, and that little horn is the papacy, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up. Those were the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, and the Heruli. kingdoms that actually the Roman Catholic Church, because of its interdiction and because of its excommunication policies, managed to overthrow by causing popular uprisings. And that's all documented in history as well. And behold, in this horn were the eyes of the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things, calling himself Holy, Holy Father, putting upon all of us, which we observe to this day, false names for our months, false names for our days, a false calendar that has nothing to do with the true calendar of God, with false pagan gods naming our days and our months and so on, or even a pagan Roman emperor such as Julius for July and Augustus for August. And September is not the seventh month. It actually, July is, but September means seventh, and October means eighth, which it isn't, and November means ninth, which it isn't, it's the 11th, and December means the 12th, means the 10th, I'm sorry, and it isn't, it's the 12th. And I think you know the meaning of the days of the week, like Tus and Thor and Freya, or Freya for Freya's Day, and Saturn, and so on. He beheld this vision till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. Now this is where they get the picture that you were taught as a child of a great judge with a huge big podium there and a gavel, and on the one hand is a trap door with fumes and flames coming out, and on the other one, I guess, is a springboard or a pogo stick or whatever to shoot you up to heaven. Anyway, there's a long line of people, and the angels are busily thumbing through all the rotten things you did, and you walk up there. I don't know if you're naked or wearing clothes. You stand before the judge, and the angels whispers to the judge, he said, he did? Boom, down you go, you know. And they preach about this, and you've been given that view of what happens as a result of the way they misunderstand this scripture. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. Millions. The judgment was set, and the books, Biblos in Greek, were opened. Now, what books are opened on your lap or that you see right there before you right now? I have in my hand books. The word Bible means books, plural, because it says holy books. It's not just one book. It's many, many books. And that's the books that are open, because it said judgment must begin today at the house of God, and if it begin at us, what shall be the judgment of them that obey not the gospel of God, what shall be the end of them? So the only way we're judged is out of the Word of God, the books of the Bible, and that's exactly what God is going to use to judge people during the millennium and in the great white throne judgment. Now, the prophecy starts with ancient Babylon, clear back 500 and more years before the time of Christ. Where does it end right here? At the establishment of the government of God on this earth. The question is, do we believe that? Do we accept that? Do we expect that? Do we think that's the next major step? There's going to come yet one coalition of governments in Europe that is going to march into Palestine. There's going to come eventually, because they will all be nuclear armed. They will all have, as we call now, WMD, or weapons of mass destruction for short. They got an acronym out for it now. Chemical and biological, as well as nuclear weapons. What do you hear in your news every single day? How many nations have chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons? Many, many. The United States, you can't even name right now, probably. You'd have to list 10 or 12 before you got started of nations that have nuclear arsenals. Israel has a big nuclear arsenal. And a lot of nations that you think don't have them, have them. There was information a couple of decades ago that Germany, West Germany, was working in cahoots with South Africa, and it actually exploded atomic devices way down in the South Atlantic. I believe myself that Brazil has the bomb. You may not think much about Brazil, but you know some of the greatest aircraft that you fly on are made from the ground up in Brazil. Brazil is quite an upcoming nation. It's a very big and very powerful nation today. Anyway, without belaboring that point, you know that China, that Pakistan, that India, that Russia, that the United States, Britain, France, etc., are all nuclear powers, and so is Israel. And you know that we in the United States have stockpiled anthrax, VX, smallpox, mustard gas, all kinds of other poisons, You remember the sheep that died up near Denver a few years back that I talked about because the groundwater had actually leached from an army base up there where some of those old canisters had broken and it got into the groundwater and farmers were losing thousands of sheep and they finally tracked it down to the fact that they were being poisoned from many miles away from an army camp. We have those things stockpiled here and there in army bases in the United States of America. Now, what those nations over there want, what Iraq wants, and you know about it, you hear about it every single day, is Iraq next on our list to go over there and bomb? I guess as an American, I hope it is, but I shouldn't say that. I've admitted before that my Americanism and my understanding of the Word of God sometimes kind of conflict and get blended in together here, and it's hard to discern just what is the will of God, but of course I have nothing to do with national policy. I just am an observer of it and not anyone that is a mover and shaker of events. Nevertheless, we live in a time where those rogue nations, as they are called, if they could get their hand... The reason that I don't think Osama bin Laden has an atomic bomb, I don't think that he has the means to deliver it, is because I know, having seen what happened on 9/11, that if he had it, he already would have used it. He would have exploded one in New York or Los Angeles or Dallas. So that is proof that he doesn't have it yet. But they've demonstrated by what they've found in the places they've occupied over there that he is working on it, that he wants it. Now, when you got multiple hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars, you can buy a nuclear bomb on the black market. If it hadn't been for some of the intelligence organizations, even of other countries, including Germany and Britain and Switzerland, to intercept buys that were made from impoverished Russians when Russia imploded, an awful lot of their nuclear arsenal, a lot of their equipment, including those suitcase bombs, I read articles about the guys would actually go and they would penetrate an area and go up to an old shed where there was nothing but a rusty old padlock that you could easily break with some bull cutters that was locking up nuclear materials over there. The military went, bonkers. I mean, people were, even officers were standing out and shaking people down on the roads in Russia. They were desperately poor. The Russian mafia's got its hands on some of them. And some of those nuclear devices have been on the black market. Because thousands of people in the old communist guard had great dachas and they had good salaries, they had limos, all those things. And all of a sudden, they're impoverished. So they were going to use anything they could to make any kind of money they could, and there have been intelligence operations which have actually preempted that and found them in places like Switzerland and East Germany where sales were about to be made of nuclear bomb-making material, of weapons-grade plutonium. I'm telling you the truth. This is not doctrine. It's just what's out there, all right? Now, we are reading prophecies that were made way back hundreds of years before the time of Jesus Christ. And they come all the way to the time yet ahead of us. Notice real quickly, and I'll conclude with this, but I want to show you, verse 13 and 14 is the second place. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came of the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, probably the only place in the Old Testament where the Father is mentioned. If Christ comes before him to the throne of God, and they brought him near before him, and we see that in Revelation 21 and 22. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. That's the last kingdom to ever rule on this good green earth. It's the kingdom of God, and it's the only solution. It's not an interim government. It's not business as usual. It's not the American form of democracy. It is not a representative form of government. It is a monarchy. It is an absolute monarchy. And he will rule with power and authority for the great good of every individual. And he will usher in upon the earth, whether they like it or not, compulsory joy. Compulsory happiness. They will all be happy and joyful because they will live according to the way that produces happiness and joy. And God says, as the days of a tree shall be the days of my people. Notice verse 17. These great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High, that's you and me, may God grant, talking about God's church and God's people shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom. It's our kingdom. We're a part of it. We're within it. We are of it and for it. It is our kingdom and shall possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. We have never heard, I've heard the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, stands my hair on end. I'm a lover of music. I am an emotional person when it comes to great, wonderful things such as the Rose Parade and 24 Palominos and snapping American flags and a tramp of U.S. Marine Corps dressed lines, absolutely perfect, walking along to the Marine Corps hymn. I still tear up when I see a vast crowd stand up, and if somebody won't hack it up, make it into a love song, sing the national anthem straight, the way it ought to be sung, is moving to me. I've never heard a chorus of a million angels singing, but I wonder what that'll sound like. What do you suppose will be Christ's national anthem? He says he's going to deliver us a new language. It shows very clearly there are going to be songs of joy, that there are going to be praises. If you think praise worship and gospel music is something that is pleasing to God today, singing love songs to Jesus, some of it may be. I don't know. Some of it is inspiring to me and some of it is not. Some of it is offensive to me. Some of it is very inspiring to me. And some of it, they just got to have like 16 climaxes. They can't leave it alone. It comes to a finish and then they go to another one. Then they come to a finish and they go to another one. It comes to a finish and they go to another one. And finally it's so high that I'm about to fall over backward looking up. I can't even see the thing. So I'm just commenting on music. That's my opinion, not doctrine. So it says here, for the third time, that it ends in the kingdom of God. All right, verse 4. Verse 21, the fourth time. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints. Look at Revelation, the 17th chapter, verse 12 through 14. And prevailed against them. And look at Revelation 13, 7, where it says the same thing, so much for a place of safety. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. That's the fourth time in Daniel 7 that the prophecy commences, clear back at the time of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar, and ends at the time of the second coming of Christ. Now, over verse 27, and the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Again, it culminates in the second coming of Christ. Finally, turn to Daniel 12, and it ends with that prophecy that talks about this great northern coalition of 10 nations coming into the land of Palestine and setting up their headquarters there. At that time, it continues on, chapter 12, verse 1, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even at that same time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, because some of them will have been in captivity, everyone that shall be found written in the book. And many of them at sleep in the dust of the earth, there's that word again, the Bible always describes death as a deep sleep. This is the time of the second coming of Christ, a resurrection occurs. Some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness, who are involved in the work of God, doing just that, as the stars forever and ever. And Daniel was told to shut up the book and seal it, and the people wouldn't understand it, but the knowledge would be increased, and many would run to and fro. And we have entered a time of world trouble such as has never occurred before in history. I'll just conclude by saying, when I was a young lad of 11, and I heard about an attack on Pearl Harbor, and didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, and as I learned a little more and a little more, a little more about the war, I was never, never fearful, either of the Japs or the Germans, we called them then, nor was I fearful about the ultimate outcome of the war. I knew America would win, and I was not fearful at home. I was not fearful to walk along the streets. I was not fearful in theaters. I was not fearful in a shopping center. I wasn't impeded by getting on an old DC-3. I wasn't impeded by getting in an automobile and showing our B sticker for gas rationing. I was secure in the United States of America because Japan was way over there. and we had a two-ocean navy. And immediately when World War II broke out, our FBI rounded up every Japanese in California and Oregon and sent them over to Idaho and Montana and put them behind barbed wire and built little towns for them, and they were just out of the way. So they weren't among us. We were at home, and this was the home front, but there weren't any battles going on. And Americans were not suspicious of each other. And we didn't have an enemy that was among us that wanted to destroy us. So don't ever slip back into business as usual and forget about 9/11 and just let it drift into the past and think that we are not living in a time of world trouble such as we've never known before. If another great attack of anthrax should occur, if a great earthquake should strike, about an 8-0, strike Los Angeles, if a nuclear weapon were to go off somewhere among us in this country or in one of our overseas bastions, then it would be horrible. And the news is, the word is, and what we're being warned about time and time again, is that actually a person who is very close to the Al-Qaeda organization, I was reading about it last night and this morning, saying that the next attack is supposed to be financial, and I think it may happen in cyberspace. I think it may happen involving the internet. It may happen involving hacking into the banking records of the United States. It may happen with regard to the economy of the United States. That is what they themselves have said, that the next blow is going to deal a death-dealing blow to our national economy. So be alert. Keep your eyes open. Don't be fearful. But God does say watch, doesn't he? Watch and pray always, Luke 21:36, that we might be accounted worthy to stand before the Son of Man.